Hey everybody, this is Chris Jackson on CFRC, letting my love shine bright, 101.9 FM.
Welcome to Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. On this episode, the fire you started will burn you. A displaced researcher and journalist from Lebanon gives us a report from the ground.
And I've interviewed hundreds of Lebanese people in and outside of Beirut who tell me if I have to sleep in my car, if I have to sleep on the road, I'll do it because there's no other way. We've been killed for 15, 16 months and no one said anything. But as soon as Hezbollah fired those six or so rockets on the 2nd of March, the entire world said, no. They want to extract the price from us and we're willing to pay it no matter what happens.
And on the resistance report, John Elmer tells us about Iranian missiles and drones battering U.S. bases.
So the reason why these are being targeted, they've been known in this region for a long time, and it speaks to the longevity of this war in Iraq, war in the region, global war on terror that normalized these bases that are now being destroyed to such a level that rebuilding them, I think rebuilding them could come into question.
This is Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. This episode highlights the news, interviews, and reports from our live stream broadcast on March 12th, 2026. Coming up later in the show, we're joined by Rokaya Chamsidin. She's a Southern Lebanese researcher, reporter, and host of the Delete Your Account podcast. We'll be discussing why Hezbollah is the only shield Lebanon has against Israeli aggression and occupation. Also, the Electronic Intifada's John Elmer looks at military movements as the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran continues. But first, with Trump's Board of Peace short on detail and filled with outsiders, Palestinians fear they may lose their homes and lands. We've published many features in the last week, but we wanted to highlight Lost Paperwork Prompts Fears for Property Rights by Malik Hijazi, writing from Gaza. When Aziza al-Mashouki, 62, a retired teacher, fled Rafah in May 2024, she left behind her house deeds, marriage certificate, and family photo albums, Hijazi writes. Quote, months later, displaced in Egypt, she learned that everything was gone. Her home, her papers, her pictures, all proof of what her life had been. Thousands of families in Gaza face similar losses. A survey conducted by the Palestinian Housing Council between May and July 2025 found widespread loss of ownership papers. In Gaza City, 71% of respondents reported losing their property documents, while in Khan Yunis and Rafah, up to 83% of women reported losing theirs. Al-Mashouki never imagined she would be leaving her home forever. It never occurred to me to take the house papers with me. Many displaced people were sheltering in our home, so we left it for them. I didn't think the house would ever be destroyed. When al-Mashouki left Rafah in May 2024, the city was sheltering over a million internally displaced Palestinians and had become a temporary humanitarian refuge, facing an impending Israeli ground invasion, which former U.S. President Joe Biden described as a red line. The invasion went ahead. Biden did nothing to prevent it and nothing to punish Israel for crossing his red line. Now, more than 90% of Rafah's neighborhoods have been completely or partially destroyed, with Israeli forces maintaining heavy military control over much of the city, preventing two-thirds of residents from returning to what is left of their homes. "We don't have digital copies of our ownership documents," Al-Mashouki told the Electronic Intifada via WhatsApp. "We worry that our right to the house will be lost because we have no proof it belongs to us. Neighbors can testify, but the fear remains." For now, Al-Mashouki has no plans to return to Gaza. There is nothing left. But she emphasizes that if reconstruction ever takes place, she would return without hesitation because, quote, "a person has nothing but their homeland." In addition to individual documents, Israel also destroyed the central archives of Gaza municipality in November 2023, erasing centuries of property records, maps, and historical documents in yet another of Israel's countless violations of the laws of war. The Gaza municipality told the Electronic Intifada via email that they have launched electronic services and interactive maps to assist residents. Any citizen who previously had documents archived at Gaza municipality can apply to obtain digital copies of these documents, the municipality added. While residents struggle to reclaim what they have lost, plans for Gaza's future are also being drawn up far from the people who live there. In January, the U.S. president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, presented AI-generated images of a new Gaza at the World Economic Forum in Davos, envisioning residential towers, data centers, luxury resorts, parks, sports facilities, and a new airport. These proposals include no indication of how the rights of those who have lost everything will be recognized or protected, or how displaced people can reclaim their homes in areas behind the yellow line. Under Palestinian and international law, the right to property is inherent and does not vanish if documents are lost, says Abdallah Sharshara, a Palestinian lawyer and human rights advocate. But without documents, claiming rights in courts or government offices is much harder. It creates serious obstacles in registration, compensation, and protection from encroachment, especially in systems that exploit legal gaps to dispossess Palestinians, he told the Electronic Intifada. The destruction of legal records follows a dangerous historical pattern. After the 1948 Nakba, hundreds of thousands of displaced Palestinians lost the documents that proved their ownership. Even those that held on to their documents found them useless, as Israel later instituted the 1950 Absentees Property Law, which classified displaced Palestinians as absentees and transferred their land and homes to the state, enabling mass confiscation and causing today's unresolved Palestinian refugee issue, afflicting millions of people. Today, international law provides broader, largely theoretical protections, but their effectiveness remains dependent on political will and actual enforcement, Sharshara said. The new Gaza proposal heightens fears. It treats Gaza as a blank slate, disregarding Palestinians who lost their homes and documents, as well as Gaza's heritage and history, while allowing outside investors to shape Gaza's future without protecting residents' rights. Those are excerpts from Lost Paperwork Prompts Fears for Property Rights by Malik Hejazi, writing from Gaza on electronicintifada.net. That's the launch of an Iranian missile. Coming up next, the Electronic Intifada's John Elmer tells us about Iranian missiles and drones battering U.S. bases.
This is the Resistance Report for day 888 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. It's the 13th day of the U.S. and Israel's war on Iran and 10th day of this newest round of the war in Lebanon. This report is covering the second week of the war. And I just want to start here with a little bit of what the Americans and Israelis are doing. They decided this week to target oil depots, strikes me as a sign of desperation to be hitting these installations so early. Things are not going as planned for the U.S. and Israel. And this was Israel targeting these. According to the Israelis, they have 80% of their air force targeting Iran and 20% targeting Lebanon right now. This happened on the weekend. The Red Crescent reporting 14,000 housing units damaged, 29 hospitals targeted, 9 of them destroyed or out of service, 65 schools targeted. So we're seeing, again, Israel being Israel here. Because, of course, this is basically chemical warfare. On the night of March 7th to the 8th, Israeli airstrikes hit multiple fuel depots and refineries across Tehran and the neighboring Al-Borz province, igniting vast pools of crude oil and refined fuel. The burning oil was sent into towering black plumes into the sky, releasing massive amounts of toxic hydrocarbons, along with sulfur and nitrogen oxides, into the lower atmosphere. As the toxic plume spread across Tehran, sulfur dioxide and nitrogen dioxide combined with moisture in the air, producing dangerous acid rain. It oil rained on them. Authorities warned residents to stay indoors as dense pollution and falling rain carried corrosive chemicals across the city. The toxic particles are inhaled. Inhaling acidic particles could irritate the airways, aggravate asthma and bronchitis, and allow fine particles to reach the bloodstream where they can increase cardiovascular stress. I think that's all obvious. You don't want to be breathing oil smoke and being rained on by oil rain. And that is the kind of crimes that Israel just normalizes in their war fighting. And I like to just start with that so we understand the human toll of what's going on in this battle. Let's take a look at the Iranians for their part. These are their missiles and drones that they're using. Of course, the Shahed-136 is the primary tool. 2,500 kilometer range allows it to target anything in the region from the coast of Israel all the way to the short haul right across the strait where a lot of the Gulf bases are set up. The Imad ballistic missile, we've seen them used basically every day. The Fatah is a hypersonic that has a maneuverable re-entry vehicle. It's a significant weapon that we have also seen nearly in every wave. The way that the IRGC has fought this battle is the field reports are done in waves. And the Khorramshahr 4, that is their newest missile, and it has a submunitions capacity. So that warhead breaks apart and distributes smaller warheads that are harder to intercept. We will see that coming up. The IRGC has fired upwards of 3,000 drones at this point and 600 ballistic missiles, almost 600 ballistic missiles, also some cruise missiles in that 600 number. And they are saying 40% are targeting Israel and 60% versus U.S. bases. They've targeted 17 vessels out in the sea. CENTCOM, for its part, the United States says they've carried out more than 6,000 airstrikes, and the Israelis say 7,500 bombs have been dropped. But the Iranians are continuing to fire undeterred by this. The Sigil, this is their newest one. We haven't seen that used. It's most advanced. The Imad, like I said, being used all the time. The Ghadr all the time as well. And the Shahab 3. This is the Khorramshahr. This is the ballistic missile that launches 80 submunitions out of the warhead. Just to give you a sense of how the field reports are done, for example, the 34th wave earlier this week, the IRGC said the firing of a targeted system of powerful and strategic Qadr, Imad, and Fatah missiles and the Khaibar hypersonic missile in the 34th wave of Operation True Promise 4 has entered the battlefield with the American and Zionist aggressors into a new phase. The gathering place of American soldiers at two bases in Al-Zafra and Al-Jafar, that's in the UAE and Bahrain, were effectively targeted by the firing of the IRGC aerospace missiles and the Vanguard attack of drones. And they said where they were targeting Ramat David Air Base in northern Israel, Haifa's naval base, and installations around Tel Aviv, including the hidden missile launchers in front of Tel Aviv. And at the end, they say Iran's target bank for attacking American and Zionist regime military and infrastructure resources in the region is 10 times the targets available to the incapable enemies. Security and stability in the region is either for everyone or it's for no one. So that was their report from the 34th wave. And these attacks are coming steady. One thing that the Israelis say, and the Americans too, they're constantly saying that the missile fire is down X number of percentages to try to make it sound like Iran cannot fire the missiles. But what they're comparing it to is on the first day when they fired 300 missiles, and that was just the opening day salvo. This is how they've handled the war since then. Roughly 20 ballistic missiles a day, along with hundreds of drones. And that has been the way they fire. Israel has said this week that 800 missiles and drones as of Tuesday have been fired at them from Iran. The IDF said that about half of the roughly 300 ballistic missiles Iran has launched into Israel so far have been of the submunition warhead. And two people were killed in Israel this week. And you can see in these launches that there's some double launches. They're clearly firing from all over the country. And it's a massive country. The next is the arrival of one of these submunitions. The submunitions come out. These are the ones from the Khorramshahr that are 80. But there's also refitted warheads on the Ghadir, which is 15 to 20 of those, as well as the arrival of a submunition of the Khorramshahr. These are single missiles. Israel is trying to get these called cluster bombs. They want them to be associated with cluster munitions that the international community has outlawed. They're clearly not cluster bombs. That's a single strike of a submunition that could be shot out of the air by any of Israel's four air defense systems if they worked. Several kilos of explosives in each one. And they're in the nose cone of the re-entry vehicle, and they break apart. But what Israel is trying to do is call them cluster bombs, which are a horrendous weapon that puts miniature bomblets. The bomb breaks open, and it showers a small area with hundreds, if not thousands, of small bombs. And this is something that Israel did famously, infamously, at the end of the 2006 war in Lebanon, when they had realized that they had lost the war. They sued for peace, and then they fired in the last days cluster bombs. Haaretz newspaper in Israel says, IDF commander, we fired more than a million cluster bombs in Lebanon. The subtitle says, phosphorus and cluster bombs heavily used, unexploded munitions litter a wide area of Lebanon. And I was in Lebanon at that time, and they were everywhere. They were hanging from trees. They were in people's houses. They were in the gardens and the shrubbery, so you couldn't see them. They're just small and they're deadly. This is what the article said, quoting the head of the IDF rocket unit. What we did was insane and monstrous. We covered entire towns in cluster bombs. Quoting the battalion commander, the rocket unit had stated that the IDF fired 1,800 cluster bombs containing over 1.2 million cluster bomblets. In addition, soldiers in the IDF artillery units testified that their army used phosphorus shells during the war, forbidden under international law, and that the multiple launch rocket systems were highly inaccurate. So these are cluster bombs. They're all in one area, and they're intended to kill civilians. The submunitions that is coming out of a ballistic missile spreads them out over multiple kilometer range. All it is doing is making a single missile into a dozen or dozens of missiles to be intercepted. Those interceptions are supposed to happen by Israel's layered multi-billion dollar, hundreds of billions of dollars air defense system, and it's not. And they're trying to call them cluster munitions because that's what Israel does, projects the things that they do criminally and hope that they can make it stick onto somebody else. We're going to watch the launch of Shahed drones here.
Ah.
So this is some of the 3,000 drones that have been launched so far. They can take off from there. They don't need to be truck mounted, although we have seen truck mounted with racks that can send out a dozen at a time. But you can also send these from the desert and fire them off relatively safely in comparison to other munitions. So this type of weapon is not going to run out, and it's been very, very effective. That's the Pava cruise missile. The Iraqi resistance is using that same type of drone. We also saw the Hadid 110 for the first time. It's a small turbo engine with 350 kilometer max that carries a 30 kilo payload. And we've seen these be used by the Iranian Navy on targets in the Gulf that are close to them. These are launched by the Iranian Army, which is also in the battle along with the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. The White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt said this week, she confirmed a report by Reuters that said as many as 150 troops have been injured since military operations began a week ago, saying that number of injured is in the ballpark of 150, something that had been covered up until now. Pentagon spokesman Sean Parnell told the Associated Press that 8 U.S. soldiers have been severely injured, noting that the majority of the injuries have been minor, with some returning to duty. 7 U.S. service members have been acknowledged to have died so far, 6 of whom were killed in Kuwait and another in Saudi Arabia. The targeting of the Kuwaiti base with a drone and the American soldier there.
Oh my God.
This is in Camp Buring. And an interesting side note, it's named after one of the highest ranking officers that was killed in the Iraq War. And he was killed in 2003 in the Al Rashid Hotel in Baghdad. And he was killed in an assassination attempt on Paul Wolfowitz, who was the biggest pusher and architect of the Iraq War. Wolfowitz survived, but Buring didn't, and they renamed this base after him. And the base is a miniature city. As people may know, these bases essentially become American cities. I watched a report on this particular base last night, and they were in Subway, they were in an arcade, they have basketball courts and gyms, they have full bus system, residence quarters. They're sprawling miniature sovereign U.S. territory. And so the reason why these are being targeted, they've been known in this region for a long time, and it speaks to the longevity of this war in Iraq, war in the region, global war on terror that normalized these bases that are now being destroyed to such a level that rebuilding them could come into question. The destruction level is such they're also largely abandoned, so their utility in this key moment is drastically reduced. This is an IRGC drone versus a U.S. hotel in Bahrain. And the IRGC said on this, the flight of the cowardly American soldiers from regional bases, they're taking refuge in hotels and host countries, and their criminal U.S. Army's use of civilian facilities in the Persian Gulf countries as cover do not escape the intelligence monitoring of the IRGC. The brave soldiers of the IRGC are laying in wait to hunt the soldiers of the aggressor American army and will not let them go. And just on a side note, the number of locals killed in these operations are very low. In the UAE, in the 13 days, there's been 4 people killed. They were migrant workers who presumably didn't have the rights to leave the job sites in the way that the locals do. There's 2 in Kuwait, both migrant workers, 2 in Saudi, also migrant workers, and 1 in Bahrain. So when you're talking about the scale of destruction and death that Israel and the U.S. rains down, more than 1,000 in Iran already, 600 in Lebanon, and of course, 100,000 in Gaza, at least. It's just worth noting those numbers. Also, Bahrain arrested the people that took that video. They have arrested a number of people. The numbers are not entirely clear, but there was a report yesterday of 6 people being arrested, migrant workers that, quote, filmed, published, and reposted videos related to the effects of Iranian aggression. And again, linking back to what Ali was saying about the Bahraini minister, this base, the U.S. Fifth Fleet base, is not so much a mountain of fire, as he called it, as it has not been able to do anything to defend Bahrain from what we are seeing. Here we're going to see an attack on the Dubai airport. You're going to see a drone come in from the right here. It's going to hit just outside of the terminal. And you can see it just misses a radar dome. It looks like that radar dome might have been the target. But this strike on the Dubai airport is part of the process of shutting down 14,000 flights in the region. Emirates Airline is the world's largest long-haul airline and by far the largest airline in the Middle East, and they are not flying. Next up, we're going to see the integrated air defense system of the IRGC and the Artesh, the Iranian army, knocking these drones, U.S. and Israeli drones, out of the sky. We don't have an exact number on this, but we've seen at least dozens of these knocked out of the sky. At one point, the IRGC said that they had hit 80. It's somewhere between dozens and that, at least, because we've shown you now a dozen just on this program alone, and I don't pick all of them. Also, next one is part of our weekly coverage of local farmers with expensive American drones. There's this local farmer in Lauristan driving his Hermes 900 drone around town. So that is the drone work that has been done. But this week, the targeting really came to light on what on these bases are being hit. We're talking about the THAAD radar, essentially eradication from the region. This is a graphic from the Financial Times that shows you the top radar. At the top is a $500 million radar. It's an advanced warning radar upon which all the system, not just the THAAD system, but this we're talking about the THAAD system here, the U.S.'s terminal high altitude area defense system that tries to intercept before the missiles come back down into the atmosphere. They're exo-atmospheric, and they use the radars from the THAAD system is connected into all the air defense systems, and it's a very powerful one. And that's the efficacy of the system, is how powerful your radar is, how sharp you're able to pick up the trajectory, the launch site, and calibrate all your air defense systems on the way in. So when you knock these out, you know, some people say it's the heart or the eyes of the system, of this multi-billion dollar system. It's a $3 billion system over the course of its lifetime. Those single radar that got knocked out is at least $500,000. And each of these THAAD systems can have 6 to 8 truck launched interceptor launchers, each one with 8. So 6 trucks by 8 is 48 launchers. That's what they have before they have to reload. And that's a $700 million outlay. And we know that last year they only made 96 total interceptors for the THAAD system. So the system itself and the interceptors is one part, but the radar itself is part of the radar for the entire system that is used by the US and Israel. The radar, it's massive. You know, it's larger than the trailer of an 18-wheeler. It's a significant radar that has a significantly algorithmically higher capacity than the smaller radars that it passes off to. And what it does is it takes the initial reading, and then it's so large and accurate and sharp, it's able to tell the smaller radars who don't have that capability, it can tell them where it's coming, and that allows the smaller radars to then be more effective. So you take out the large radar, now your small radars are not effective. And this is a problem that for the US and Israel that will compound itself, and replacing them in battle is a long shot, although they're talking about taking the THAAD system out of South Korea. So sorry about that, South Korea, I guess, for the Americans, promise to protect you, but actually we're just going to move your air defense system because we are getting ours all blown up. And these have been hit in concerted effort in radar communications and air defense systems in Qatar, UAE, Jordan, Bahrain, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia. The damage on Muwafaq al-Salti, this is the base in Jordan. According to CNN, satellite photos show a Raytheon AN/TPY-2 radar and support equipment used by the U.S. THAAD missile defense system was destroyed in Muwafaq al-Salti air base in Jordan in the opening days of the war. And I reported on this in the build-up to the war, because Muwafaq al-Salti base was being used for more fighter jets than we had seen. There was at least 60 additional ones on top of the U.S. Expeditionary Wing. The radar system for the THAAD and the transporter radar manufactured by Raytheon, according to the 2025 Missile Defense Agency budget, costs $500 million, as I have said. This is another one showing the base. You can see, again, clearly see the damage. It's out in the open in the desert, and you don't see missed strikes all around it. It looks like the precision of these weapons are not area weapons. They're not missing by 20 or 30 feet. You're seeing direct on hits. This image shows a pair of 13-foot craters in the sand near the radar system, suggesting that it may have taken multiple attempts to hit the system, which is split across 5 40-foot trailers. According to the CNN report, all appear to be destroyed or seriously damaged. So they're picking them off one by one. They can do that with their drones. The U.S. has a really difficult time finding the drones in themselves, and they're using those drones to knock out the ballistic missile defense systems in these countries. And the Iranians said on day 9, the spokesperson for the IRGC said that the highly advanced radars of the THAAD system, which have an extremely long range and have been destroyed during operations to suppress the enemy's anti-missile defense in the region, 4 highly advanced U.S. THAAD system radars were targeted and destroyed. The highly advanced long-range THAAD radars located in Al-Rubayah, Al-Ruwais in the UAE, and Al-Kharj in Saudi Arabia, and Al-Azraq, that's Muwafaq al-Salti in Jordan, were targeted and destroyed in a 24-hour period of time. This is the early warning radar in Qatar, and this is a critical piece of all of the air defense. This is the most powerful radar, and it's the radar upon which all the other radars rely. And we can see here that it has been totally destroyed as well. So very significant for a long battle of attrition that the air defense systems are already struggling to a significant degree based on precision targeting by the Iranian military. So that is the resistance report for day 888 of Israel's genocide.
That was John Elmer. You're listening to Electronic Intifada Radio with me, Nora Barrows-Friedman. Now we go to Lebanon to join researcher, journalist, and Electronic Intifada contributor Rokaya Chamsidin. Before we hear from her, the Electronic Intifada's executive director Ali Abunima recaps what's happening there.
Since the United States and Israel launched their war of aggression aiming to topple the government of Iran on February 28th, Lebanon has once again become a major front line of confrontation. On March 2nd, the resistance group Hezbollah launched rockets and drones against Israeli military targets. This followed the U.S.-Israeli murder of Iran's leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei and more than 10,000 Israeli violations of a so-called ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon signed in November 2024, along with the continued Israeli occupation of Lebanese territory in violation of that agreement. Israel has launched a bombing campaign across Lebanon's south and east, particularly in the southern suburb of Beirut, striking homes and infrastructure in densely populated neighborhoods. Lebanese authorities report that almost 600 people have been killed and more than 1,400 wounded since the escalation began, while over 750,000 people are displaced, mostly from the south, as families flee Israeli bombardment. Aid agencies warn that hospitals are overwhelmed and the country faces a deepening humanitarian crisis as hundreds of thousands seek shelter in schools, vehicles, and improvised camps. In Nebishit, in the eastern Bekaa Valley, on the night of March 6th to 7th, Israeli helicopters inserted a commando unit that attempted to dig up a grave in a cemetery, searching for the remains of an Israeli military pilot who has been missing for decades. The infiltration was discovered and Hezbollah fighters and local residents confronted the invaders. Israeli warplanes launched dozens of airstrikes to cover the withdrawal of the troops. The airstrikes and fighting killed at least 41 people and wounded around 40 in Nebishit, and the Israeli forces withdrew. Hezbollah is responding to Israel's attacks on Lebanon with sustained rocket, missile, and drone fire against Israeli military positions and settlements. Israel has admitted it is having difficulty intercepting the group's drones. Politically, the escalation has intensified divisions inside Lebanon. The Western-backed government has attempted to outlaw Hezbollah, accusing it of drawing the country into a wider war. The movement and its supporters insist Israel's repeated violations of Lebanese sovereignty make armed resistance unavoidable. The only question, they say, is whether Israel should be allowed to choose the moment of a major escalation or whether the resistance should take the initiative. Joining us now from Lebanon is Ruqayya Shamsuddin. She is a southern Lebanese researcher and reporter and co-host of the Delete Your Account podcast. She herself has been forcibly displaced from the Dahiya, Beirut's southern suburb, and she joins us now from Beirut. Ruqayya, welcome to the Electronic Intifada.
Thank you so much for having me on again. I'm honored to be here with y'all.
So good to have you again, Ruqayya.
Thanks, Ruqayya. As I just said, you are displaced. Describe for us what you have experienced since the March 2nd escalation and what the situation is right now for people in Beirut, especially those from the Dahiya and the south of the country.
So since March 2nd, this is the latest Israeli aggression, an extension of the ongoing over 16-month aggression against Lebanon. The very fabric of daily life in Beirut, not just in Dahiya, but in the southern regions and in the Bekaa Valley, has been violently targeted by the U.S. and Israel. And I want to make that clear. This isn't just Israel, because the U.S. is more or less leading the charge here, but this is a forcible displacement. We are being ethnically cleansed. No one is heeding Israeli warnings. They are telling us, we are going to bomb your neighborhoods. We're going to bomb the houses, the residential buildings. And if you've ever been to Dahiya, if you've ever seen photos of Dahiya, the buildings are nestled very close to one another. So if there is a so-called targeted bombing, I don't even like describing that way, it will knock out other buildings, other stores. People have been forced to leave behind every possession they have. But at the same time, our community is very resilient. We've been forced to be resilient. But displacement has become a daily condition for over 700,000 people. And those are just the people that have registered as being forcibly displaced. What's happening and what I've seen, there are people sleeping in front of the ocean. There are people sleeping on top of buildings outside of Dahiya and Shiyeh. But again, we understand that we need to be resilient, and this resilience is inseparable from the resistance. And we understand that we're going to remain as strong as possible in order to continue this. One positive that I've seen out of all of this is just how strong our community has been despite what we've been forced to endure. And Israel has announced that they will bomb Dahiya and Shiyeh and multiple places in surrounding areas. Places that we walk every single day, places that we have raised our families every single day. So this is what we're forced to endure, and we're forced to endure it in the shadows of, as you said, a complicit government which has abandoned us.
How people from the south and from the southern suburb of Beirut, how are they being treated in different parts of the country? Are people welcoming them? Are people making efforts to provide refuge, shelter, food, and so on for this enormous number of displaced people? It's something like almost a quarter of Lebanon's population.
Right. And while there have been people who have been offering food and shelter, because people need to understand, these are not just individuals. Whenever there was the first announcement to hit Dahiya, I was actually on the road. All of a sudden, I mean, in the taxi, everyone was wondering why the traffic had stopped. And it was because Abichai had announced that everyone needs to leave Dahiya now because they're going to hit Dahiya. And I want people to picture that. No warning, really. And then being told everything you have, you're going to lose it. Everything, wherever you're coming from, you need to leave. People are walking on foot from different villages in South Lebanon, walking on foot from Dahiya. And while Lebanon is small, the areas are massive. So you're walking for hours. People abandoned their vehicles out of fear of what was coming. So there have been people opening their homes and offering food and shelter and what have you. But at the same time, there is a large portion of this country who are being discriminatory against those from South Lebanon. They will discriminate against you based on your accent, based on the way that some women wear the hijab, because they wear it a certain way in the southern villages. And then they're charging 6 months rent as if they're a hotel. You can live here, but I need 6 months. I need you to pay for management services, whatever that is, cleaning services, or they're refusing to let you stay at all because of where you're from. They say out of fear that Israel will target the buildings, but it is a form of discrimination that this community has faced for decades. It did not begin now.
Rokaya, in the introduction, Ali talked a little bit about the Israeli attack in the town of Nabishit in the eastern Bekaa Valley. You went there yourself just a few days ago. You posted a brief video on social media. Let's watch it and then tell us about what you saw in the town and what people told you about the Israeli invasion and attack. Let's go to that video.
I'm in the village of Nabishit, Kalaba, reporting from the Israeli attack.
Tell us what we saw just there. Tell us about the attack.
So the attack occurred around the 7th or 8th of March. There was an overnight incursion into the village of Nabishit, nearby the village of Nabishit. A full expansion into the village was sought by not only Hezbollah, but locals, residents. The town, once you go into the town, the heart of the town, the mayor's house was completely bombed. The bombing was so intense. There's images that I took of the vehicles. They were actually up into the buildings, into the height of the buildings. That's like four levels. The vehicles were all the way up top. The crater was so massive, it reminded me of the attacks that happened in Harat Tahrik in Dahiyah, the one that killed Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. That was something that I was reminded of whenever the Israelis went in to allegedly get the remains of the pilot. His name is Ron Arad. I frankly don't care what his name is. They went in, and the people that were there around the cemetery, they noticed that there was digging. Something was happening. And one story I want to tell people that I'm going to try and cover in depth later is that a woman with her family, her children, I believe her oldest son was in his 20s, saw what was happening, and she pulled out her gun. I don't know what type of gun, but she had a gun, and they approached her house where her children were, and she shot at them. I was told that at least two of them were shot by her. I don't know what happened to them, but they ended up killing her and killing all of her children. And that was near the cemetery that they were digging. And the cemetery belongs to the Shukr family. And one of the members of the Shukr family was actually abducted. He's one of the prisoners being held and tortured by Israel. Currently, over 20 Lebanese citizens are being held in captivity, and our government has done and said nothing about them. But whenever I went into the village, this is in the eastern part of Lebanon. It is not South Lebanon. The area of Baalbek, the people there are known to be incredibly fierce, strong, and armed. Women and men, and even children, know how to defend their community in the eastern area of Lebanon. It is very beautiful. But everywhere I went in the village, there was signs of not just the attack that happened a few days ago, but attacks that happened before. At one of the sites where they killed 13 people, they had actually killed people nearby before, including children. The youngest person that they killed in the recent incursion and attack on Nabishit was only 2 years old. I watched as the casket went by. It was incredibly moving because of just how loved all of these people were. It's a very tight-knit community. Everyone knew everyone. I was honored to be able to speak and sit with a lot of the martyrs' families. One of them was a very old woman. She told me how her son was engaged. His wedding was in 5 months, and they killed him before he was supposed to get married. And this also involved the Lebanese army, because before the Israelis went into the village, there were signs that something was happening. They were coming in. This is how disturbing the situation is. They were coming in wearing Lebanese army uniforms and an ambulance made to look like a Lebanese health authority ambulance. So this was pre-planned. And then a few days ago, they tried again to go into Nabishit and were prevented from doing so. So this was a collaborative effort by Hizb, the locals that were fighting, and also the army helped.
So, Rukai, you're saying the Israelis tried to come in disguised as medics?
They tried to come in disguised as members of the Lebanese army. And yes, they used an ambulance to try and go in as well.
Which, of course, is a war crime under international law. It's a war crime to impersonate medical personnel. I believe it's even a war crime to wear the uniforms of another army. That's the crime of perfidy. We saw this tactic in Gaza, the most intense parts of the ongoing genocide. But of course, this is an army that has no red lines, has no morals, respects no law. You know, it's been a few years, but I've been to Eastern Lebanon and it is absolutely beautiful. I've also been to the south and I've visited many of the villages there. And these are beautiful places. Talk about what you saw between, you know, traveling to the Bekaa Valley and when you were in Nabishit. How widespread is the bombing? How present are the Israeli attacks on Lebanon right now?
So in the eastern part of the Bekaa Valley, they're not just bombing different villages. They're also picking off members of the resistance or anyone associated. Some of them aren't even part of Hezbollah, using drone strikes. This is happening in Bekaa Valley. They're bombing the mountains. They're bombing the villages. They're bombing the roads. The area of eastern Lebanon, like South Lebanon, the way that they're built is that if you cut off one road, you can cut off all access to the entire village, which is something they intend to do. Whenever they hit Nabishit, they also hit an area where the water and the power was, intentionally trying to make it so this community, if the Israelis went in and stayed, they're going to be starved. They're going to be prevented from having any access to the outside world. Because again, this is a very tiny village they already have a rough time getting in and out of these places. And I want to briefly talk about South Lebanon. My village, Adab Salim, I've written for Electronic Intifada about Adab Salim before. They've hit our village at least 5 times in the last week and a half. They killed 4 members of my extended family in Zawtar Sharkiye, which is outside of Adab Salim. They had just built their house. I believe they just newly built a house there. And they targeted them while they were having either suhoor or iftar. It happened at night and they killed everyone. 2 children, the mother and the father. So this is what we're dealing with. And we're not the only family that has suffered this. And in eastern Lebanon, they've taken out entire families, including today. They killed at least 7 people. They're killing paramedics. They're doing double task strikes. They're trying to make it so not only are they going to ethnically cleanse us, but they're putting a price on being in solidarity with the resistance. That's also why they're hitting Dahiya. If people think they're hitting Hezb infrastructure in Dahiya, you're kidding yourself. They're doing this in order to extract a price. They're saying, if you want to support Hezbollah, we're going to take everything from you. And I've interviewed hundreds of Lebanese people in and outside of Beirut who tell me, if I have to sleep in my car, if I have to sleep on the road, I'll do it because there's no other way. We've been killed for 15, 16 months and no one said anything. But as soon as Hezbollah fired those 6 or so rockets on the 2nd of March, the entire world said, no, no, no. They want to extract a price from us and we're willing to pay it no matter what happens.
Well, let's talk more about that. The government of President Joseph Aoun and Prime Minister Nawaf Islam have declared that Hezbollah is now outlawed and must surrender its weapons. And in an unprecedented move, the government is also asking for direct negotiations with Israel on how to disarm Hezbollah. Hezbollah's leadership, including, of course, Secretary General Naim Qasem and its parliamentary leader, Mohammad Raad, in the last few days have issued very strong statements rejecting this and insisting on the right to resist and saying, you know, if the army can't or won't defend us, people have the right to defend their land against occupation. This looks like, you know, this division has been there in Lebanon, but this seems like an unprecedented rupture, almost like a point of no return. Talk about what's happening politically, your view of the government's moves, and give us some more about how people are reacting. You just talked a bit about what people are telling you, but give us more insight into this development.
So the political maneuvers by the government, namely Joseph Aoun and Prime Minister Nawaf Salam, like you said, they've declared Hezbollah illegal and they want to openly, we've known they're negotiating through what's called the mechanism under the table with indirect and sometimes maybe even direct talks. It's a bit shady there, but this reveals that there's a fracture within the state apparatus and the tensions inherent in Lebanon that continue to exist under the shadow of imperial design. So there's no ambiguity here. Hezbollah's weapons are not an instrument of political contestation. They're a shield. They're the only defense that we have. That's it. The Lebanese army, they set up their tents all across the southern Lebanese villages. And what happened? They pulled out. The government told them to leave. So what are we supposed to do? The government's saying, we're not going to protect you. The Lebanese army is not going to protect us. So again, the only shield we have is Hezbollah. And Hezbollah is the tangible expression of our right to resist occupation and to defend our people against a history of foreign aggression that stretches back during the time of Jabal Amman, when Lebanese people were resisting alongside Palestinians. And as you mentioned, Sheikh Naim Asim and parliamentary leader Mohammed Raad have consistently affirmed that the resistance is a national duty and a moral imperative, one that can't be disarmed at, you know, the behest of those who would leave Lebanon exposed and vulnerable. The Lebanese state is begging to have this be over and done with, while also not giving us any guarantees that we'll be safe. Because as we've seen, before this current situation, they killed over 350 people. I was making a list of their names every day. So demand that we surrender in the midst of a war is to ask us to abandon the principles of self-determination that define our history, and then to accept this logic of submission. And you, the saying that we have, hayhat min al-zilla, is I would rather die than face this humiliation. So every missile Hezbollah launches, every defensive action that they take is an assertion that Lebanon is not a colony and that our people are not subjects to anyone, whether that be this Mahmoud Abbasian state that we have, and that our resistance is rooted in the consciousness of oppression and the pursuit of liberation. Sheikh Naim Asim said, that's it. We're not going to give up our weapons. We're warning you that we can only tolerate so much. So what do they expect us to do? So this is a continuation of a struggle that's both ethical and existential to us. And so to disarm under these conditions would be to erase the memory of all those who have resisted before us and to hand our people the inheritance of subjugation. And we refuse.
The situation in Lebanon, where you have this division between resistance and essentially collaborators, we see that also in Palestine. You mentioned Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority, which collaborates openly with Israel and considers the resistance to be criminal. We also see it on a regional level now, as the United States and Israel are waging this war of aggression against Iran and are being backed by Arab states in the region by quite a number. Put what's happening in Lebanon in the regional context. How do you see what's happening with Iran? Is this an inevitable battle or war that has been building up for a while, or is it another episode in this series of start-stop escalations that we've been all living with for so long? What are your thoughts on the war with Iran?
I think this is part of an ongoing battle that the resistance has been preparing for in the long run. And what we're seeing with the attacks on Dubai, the attacks on Bahrain, Kuwait, a lot of people on the outside are wondering why Iran is targeting these areas. But these are vassal states that have been taking advantage of the bloodshed in the region, that have been benefiting and profiting off of the bloodshed in the region. And they've been watching as our communities are torn apart, not just in Lebanon, but in Gaza and in wider Palestine. They've been watching and they've been benefiting from it financially. So this, in my opinion, was inevitable and it's much deserved. The Gulf regimes deserve what is happening to them because they have refused to be anything more than at the behest of the United States. And Iran has basically put a price on it. They've said, okay, you want to be a vassal state? You want to hold these U.S. interests? You want to have these bases? We're going to extract as much pain from what you are doing, because this is, it sounds harsh to a lot of people, but this is much deserved. And we've been waiting to watch Dubai burn after everything that they've done to us and to Sudan, by the way. So I think that if Iran, and in my opinion, they will come out triumphant, this will put an end to a lot of the bloodshed that we've been enduring for decades.
Of course, you know, none of us want to see people who are uninvolved hurt or injured in any country. That's not what we want. But we're speaking, of course, in terms of the regional and geopolitics.
Absolutely. These are colonies. These are people that have basically made sure that they will pocket as much money from what's happening. And they thought that having a U.S. base in their country would keep them safe. And Iran has blasted through that mythology.
Rokhaya, for people who have been not grasping the enormity of this existential war, really, for Palestinians, for Lebanese, for Iranians, for people who are resisting not just the tip of the spear that is Israel of the Western imperial project, but the U.S., which is, of course, the spear itself. Talk about how important Iran has been in terms of supporting the Lebanese resistance and what would happen if the U.S. and Israel were to enact this sort of greater Israel project across the region and try and turn Iran into yet another, you know, Western vassal state. How important is Iran to Lebanon right now?
It's incredibly important because the final frontier in this battle against Israel and the United States, and without Iran, not only would the Lebanese resistance, Hezbollah, Harakat Aman even, but a lot of Palestinian groups who have benefited from financial, political support from Iran, it would undermine everything that has been happening for the last however many decades that Iran has been supporting the Palestinian people and the Lebanese people. Because again, in Lebanon, the Lebanese army is not even allowed to use the weapons that they have, which hold, to target Israel. That's actually written in the agreement that our state has with the lovely Americans. So what do we have? We have Hezbollah. That's what we have. And the Palestinians have Hamas, and they have the PFLP, and they have numerous other resistance groups that have been supported by Iran. Iran has not benefited from supporting the Palestinians or the Lebanese people. It's the total opposite. The more that they've supported us, the more pain that the U.S. has inflicted on them by way of sanctions and now by way of killing over 1,300 people, many of them children. So if we lose Iran, it will be more devastating than losing Syria, which is now under the government of former Al-Qaeda leader Jolani. So if Iran falls, the region falls. And this is not an exaggeration.
The stakes couldn't be higher. And we're so grateful to you for your reporting. And we pray for your safety and the safety of everyone in Lebanon. You are keeping incredibly busy and doing tremendously important reporting that we are not getting from too many places right now in Lebanon. And you're doing it while you're displaced and suffering all of the same difficulties that so many people in Lebanon are facing, and you are still keeping this up. We're so grateful to you, Rokhaya. Please stay as safe as you can, and thank you so much for joining us today.
No, thank you all so much, and I can't wait to come back on. Inshallah, next time all of our villages will be liberated when I come back on.
Exactly. Thank you, Rokhaya.
That was Lebanese researcher and reporter Rokhaya Chamsedin. Thank you for tuning into Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. For more interviews, reports, and analysis, along with feature articles, podcasts, and our live stream, check out electronicintifada.net. Produced by Pierre Loisel, Nora Barrows-Friedman, and Tamara Nassar. The Electronic Intifada is a program service of the Middle East Cultural and Charitable Society, Incorporated, a 501c3 nonprofit organization.
Hello, my beautiful listeners. Welcome back to episode 2 of Songs of the Season.